2183, House Bill 2184, and 2185. The first two we're going to just do public hearings on today, and we will not go into work session on those. On the first one, House Bill 2183, guests Ms. Howard and Ms. Pratt, please come forward.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
My name is Vanita Howard, and I'm a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on Driving Under the Influence of Intoxicants. I sometimes abbreviate that rather long term to just the Governor's Drunk Committee, but some people object to that classification. This bill that you have before you this morning stems from a number of discussions that we've had in the committee for quite a few years about the problem of the repeat offender for driving under the influence. Our committee this year proposes lowering the BAC for a repeat offender from 0.08 to 0.05 as a way to send a very strong message to people that repeated poor choices when it comes to drinking and driving will not be tolerated. The count period on a record for the driver also would be extended from 10 years to 15 years. And this count period would apply to both drivers with convictions for driving under the influence and those who have been through the diversion program as a first offender. I think we need to keep in mind when we look at this bill that almost 27% of all DUI offenders in Oregon are repeat offenders. And when we discuss reducing the BAC level for repeat offenders, we also need to keep in mind that we are not really breaking new ground here. In fact, Oregon law already has a zero tolerance level for those under 21 years of age. It is also illegal for commercial drivers to operate a commercial vehicle with a BAC of 0.04 or more. And if they do so, they will lose their commercial license for 1 year for a first offense or for 3 years if they are driving a vehicle with hazardous materials. A second offense for that commercial driver results in lifetime suspension of their commercial license. We think that House Bill 2183 would provide one more tool to drive home the fact that repeat offenders need to resolve their drinking problem before they can legally drive on today's highways. And if you look at the BAC levels of people who are arrested for DUI, as well as those who are killed in failed crashes, I'm sorry to say that most of these offenders probably have a 0.05 when they wake up in the morning. They're very practiced drinking drivers. In other words, they're also very hardcore drinking. They have a very hardcore drinking problem. I've attached to my testimony a very recent study from the state of Maine, where they have now imposed an absolute zero tolerance level for repeat offenders. And this study indicates that it does seem to be having some very positive results. That concludes my statement.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ann Pratt. I am a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUI. I am a newly appointed member. I'm also a member of Crime Victims United, and I'm a Lane County MAD board member. I can't ever start out this session without mentioning our personal tragedy, which was losing our 23-year-old son in 1998. Since that time, I see year after year of other similar tragedies, and in this last year, in 2003 statistic, we lost 207 Oregonians on our highways to DUI, and approximately another 2,000 are seriously injured. And each year I collect a very fat file on DUI deaths and injuries, many, many, many of them repeat offenders. We all deserve to have safe roadways. And each year in Oregon, according to ODOT, we have 25,000 DUI offenses approximately. And in 2003, we had 11,000 convictions and well over 12,000 diversions. About one-third of all drivers who are convicted of driving while intoxicating or driving under the influence are repeat offenders. And the risk of a driver who has one or more DUI convictions becoming involved in a fatal crash is about 1.4 times the risk of a driver with no DUI conviction. We need to get tougher and take more aggression against these high-risk repeat offenders. How many chances do they get? House Bill 2183 is about getting tougher, and four states have already lowered the blood alcohol limit for conviction for repeat DUI offenders. Maine in 1988 did so. They lowered it to 0.05. Then they lowered it even lower. They eventually to 0.02 in 95 and 00 a little bit later. North Carolina followed with a 0.04, then Wisconsin, Tennessee, Utah, and Connecticut with similar laws. House Bill 2183 would not only place us in line with what's happening to combat the potentially deadly problem of repeat offenders, but also align us in what this medical community regards as intoxication, which is 0.05. At VACs, as low as 0.02% alcohol affects driving ability and crash likelihood, the probability of a crash begins to increase significantly at 0.05 and climbs rapidly after about 0.08. We're requesting this bill at 0.05 for repeat offenders who are within a 15-year time period of the current offense and have already participated in a diversion or have been convicted of driving under the influence. This makes good public safety sense, and it's proven to work. MAD also supports this bill, as it does all three of these bills on the table this morning. The Governor's Advisory Committee urges you to pass this bill. And I also have my testimony and MAD testimony here.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions from the committee?
Eventually.
Okay, eventually. If you want to ask something, it's a good time now.
Yes.
Go ahead.
In your testimony, Anne, it said that in Maine, it was the first to lower the blood alcohol content for repeat offenders to 0.05 with immediate results. What were the results? Was it more convictions, more suspensions? Were there less fatalities? What were the results?
There were less fatalities. There was 25% fewer fatalities where other states had increases in fatalities.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Jeff Roost.
Rost. Good morning, Chairman Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Rost. I am here today to represent the Oregon State Police Forensic Services Division. And I have the honor of participating with the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII, and have worked closely with Ms. Pratt and Ms. Howard, and want to first state that I've provided for you today written testimony. I'm just going to paraphrase that very briefly, but say that my position here today is to not oppose House Bill 2183 in any way. I've been part of the discussions and the development of House Bill 2183. I think that the only point that I would make for purposes of the committee is the recognition that by lowering the per se blood alcohol concentration from 0.08 to 0.05 in the case of repeat offenders does potentially bring in approximately an additional 5 to 7% of cases that would subsequently be now what we would consider to be contested cases. It's basically making an additional classification of offender. And because of the increase in those contested cases, and because blood alcohol concentration is going to be the issue, that is likely going to have an impact on the Forensic Services Division in terms of the cases that we will need to provide expert witness testimony and support for. As many of you probably already know, the Forensic Services Division over the past several years has gone through reductions in staff and layoffs. We are currently triaging the majority of the casework that is entering the laboratory system, and many police officers have already been hampered by reductions in the numbers of intoxilizer instruments that we have located around the state. And so I think that just highlights the fact that, that the Forensic Services Division is already strained under the requests for services that the criminal justice community has placed upon it. The concern with creating an additional approximate 1,000 to 1,500 or 1,300 to 1,800 contested cases per year is going to result in an increase in the number of requests coming to the Forensic Services Division for expert witness testimony. And so while we don't oppose this legislation, we certainly do present probably a fair picture of the recognition that that's going to increase the workload for the Forensic Services Division, and there needs to be a corresponding allocation of funding or resources in order to accommodate that. Thank you.
Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ross, am I understanding that it is more difficult then to identify the level of blood alcohol if it's at a 0.05 level than it is at 0.08? I mean, it's not simply equally easy to determine what that level is, and because if that were the case, it would seem that it wouldn't add any additional cost.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, no, that's not what I'm saying. There's no problem with identifying the particular blood alcohol concentration. What I'm saying is currently blood alcohol concentrations of less than 0.08 are generally cases that are not being prosecuted, whereas cases, you know, unless you have strong supporting evidence of impairment, those cases are generally not going to be prosecuted by district attorney's offices. So essentially what you're doing here by lowering the presumptive level to 0.05, you are essentially creating additional cases that are going to be subject to prosecution that were previously not. And that's where the additional casework is going to, or caseload is going to come from.
So, follow up, Mr. Chair. So it's the follow-on sort of supporting the chain of custody of samples and sort of appearing to testify in proceedings. That's the extra resource issue. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman and Representative McPherson, generally, yes. It's not necessarily chain of custody or those issues, but generally it's going to be providing expert witness testimony about what, you know, what is the impact of having a blood alcohol concentration of 0.05. Does that substantiate the impairment that the officer was seeing? Now, if there's the need for any retrograde extrapolation or calculations as to what they were at the time of driving, that type of testimony, that's generally the type of testimony we'd be providing in these cases.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And can you say how much would somebody have to drink to come up to a 1.5, 170-pound man, for example? Do you know that? Could you tell me that?
I'm sorry.
How much would a person have to drink to reach the 0.05?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, it's going to depend on somebody's body weight, but I guess I don't know the exact answer. I could probably ballpark it for you, but if you were looking at generally a 175-pound male, you're going to be probably in that 3 to 4 drinks in an hour range for sure, maybe slightly less than that.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else have any further questions? Thank you. Next, we have Paul Romain, Bill Perry, and Kelly Skye, please.
I don't know if you want all three of us up together or whether...
Sure.
Okay, all right, we're opposed.
All right.
Thank you. Just wanted to make sure. And coordinated here.
Otherwise, I'd make her sit in the middle if she's there, right? You need to pick whoever you'd like to start.
Okay. Being the shy, retiring type, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romain. I'm here representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. Let me give you a little anecdotal thing. First of all, when my children were little, I was at a place called O'Callaghan's, I think it was. It was down on off of 217 in Portland or Beaverton, whatever, Tigard, whatever the town is there. And they had one of these breathalyzer machines there. So I wanted to show the kids what you could drink and what you couldn't drink. So I told them, I said, look, I am a 175-pound male, and I've been that way for a long time. And I've been drinking, you know, my whole life. I've never been convicted of a drunk conviction or anything like that. I don't drink to excess. And I said to them, I'm going to show you. I'm going to have 2 beers with my meal, and I will be under 0.08. I'll be fine. I had 2 beers, and I blew on the breathalyzer, and I was 0.08. I handed the keys to my wife, and she drove home. Fortunately, she was there with me at that time. But what I'm saying is that, generally speaking, within an hour, if you figure per drink, about 0.03. So you're going to probably be at about 0.06 after 2 beers. It's not a big number. Now, a smaller woman like my wife would be much more. I mean, she weighs 100 pounds. She's a wisp, little wisp of a thing, and 2 beers, and she wouldn't know what town she's in. But I can do a little bit more. It's a very low standard. 0.08 is the national standard. It wasn't, basically, until the feds pretty much blackmailed everybody by saying they'd take away the highway funds. But what you have to decide as a committee is, when do you get government involved? At what point? Because, frankly, there's a lot of reasons why people are impaired out there driving on the highway. Probably the most impaired I've ever been was sleep deprived when I was dating. You know, you'd stay up all night and be somewhere, and I wasn't illegal per se. I could have been pulled over for reckless driving because I was driving poorly or something, but I wasn't illegal per se. What you're saying with this is you're saying you are illegal, you are convicted per se. It's not a rebuttable presumption. If you blow 0.08 now, you're guilty, period. And what's happening here is they want to lower it down to 0.05 and say, if you blow 0.05, you are guilty. And it covers the person who made a mistake when they were 23 and now are 37 within 14 years, and they do something, they happen to have two beers. That's what this bill covers. What we do not oppose and have never opposed is things that really go after the true high-end repeat offender. Because the ones who are causing the problem out there are blowing 0.20, 0.25, 0.18, and they're doing it constantly. And this bill does nothing to get after them. It does everything to make somebody maybe feel a little bit good. But it doesn't go after the true repeat offender. We shocked pretty much everybody a few years back when Earl Blumenauer was the now congressman, was city councilor. He called our organization and said, I just wanted to give you a heads up. We're going to introduce a vehicle forfeiture provision at the city of Portland, where if you're convicted of second conviction, or you lose your vehicle. And we just wanted to let you know, because you've been a friend. We said, we'll be down there to support you. And we were the lead people to support it, because it went after the repeat offender, and it took away the car. It did send a message that way. We're not opposed to those things that really go out there and get the repeat offender. We would support anything along those lines. But what this is, the real agenda long term, is to somehow institutionalize 0.05 in the statute, in the mindset, and eventually lower everybody down to that level. That's all it is. Thank you.
Any questions?
Is there anything in this bill as it stands that you would change or manipulate to make it more acceptable, or you just think the whole thing should be just left as it is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, I would, I'd be willing to talk to people about things in the bill. I mean, the way the bill's set up right now, it does two things. It basically, or one thing basically, it lowers it to 0.05 for a certain set of folks. You know, the 0.05 we have a very big problem with. So, you know, yeah, if you wanted to look at ways to go after the person who was 0.15, 0.20, even a couple of 0.08s within a given period of time, that we would be more than happy to take a look at, but not lowering the BAC to 0.05. Thank you.
And the disputable presumption, just because you have those numbers doesn't necessarily guarantee a conviction, so those are disputable, just technically speaking.
Well, you can, you can dispute the number, but once the number is, if you've established that number, that's it, you're drunk. One other point, you can, Mr. Chair, you can be convicted of driving under the influence at 0.02, 0.01.
I understand that.
Anything. It's just you have to do some work to actually get the conviction.
I want to hear Kelly tell me that's not a disputable, but anyway, that's okay. Please.
Good morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we too oppose House Bill 2183. And it seems that every session we have new bills dealing with driving under the influence of intoxicants, and we continue to tinker with this statute and make it more and more complicated, in some ways making it less effective as a deterrent, because people really can't keep up with the changes that we make to the law. Each session, someone comes down with a particular concern about a particular portion of this law that they want to make more and more restrictive. We have concerns about that for a number of reasons. First, I would echo the concerns of Mr. Romaine, being that this bill, if it intends to go after repeat offenders, is going to capture and going to cause us to spend money on prosecuting what I would call some not-so-strong cases. In my experience, 11 years as a public defender working, representing people in DUI cases and traffic-related cases, repeat offenders, as Mr. Romaine said, don't come in with a 0.05 to a 0.08. They come in well above the legal limit. And so this particular bill is not going to do anything to the person who comes in on their second offense at a 0.12 or a 0.20. What it will do is increase litigation, because as the state police have pointed out, it will increase litigation on these cases. And frankly, I was surprised to hear the number of cases that they thought it would increase, but not only is it going to increase the cost of the state police, but it's going to increase the cost of indigent defense, because every time the state brings in an expert witness, indigent defense is ethically required to at least explore the necessity of having our own expert witness. So you will increase cost that way. Our concern about this shifting of costs is that when we increase the money that we're putting into the criminal justice system, we're taking that money out of the system at the other end. We're taking it out of social services. We're making alcohol treatment less available to the people who need it. We are reducing the money that we put into the Oregon Health Plan, which helps people to get the treatment that they need, and we're less able to treat or to help people with poverty and the other things that may cause them to lose control of an alcohol addiction. So for all of those reasons, we oppose House Bill 2183.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Skye, when is an individual entitled to indigent defense for a DUI prosecution?
The Chair Barker and Representative McPherson, the Public Defense Services Commission sets the sort of a formula that they use, And, you know, I don't have access to that information right now, but there's a confidential affidavit that an indigent person who is applying for court-appointed counsel has to fill out, and I could get a copy of that affidavit for you. And then they have different levels. If you are considered indigent, then you would be eligible for a court-appointed attorney at no cost. And now under the application contribution program, if you have, say, a small amount of resources, then they can actually charge that person.
Actually, I wasn't speaking so much to the resource level, but the general standard is if you're subject to incarceration, then you have a right to defense, but not if it's a penalty, like an economic penalty, is my impression. Maybe I'm oversimplifying. And I guess what I'm really getting at is loss of license, for example. Is that a basis on which a person would have a right to an indigent, to defense as an indigent, or is it purely an incarceration-triggered issue? So it'd be people who are repeat offenders already that they would... help me out with understanding this sort of...
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, you're absolutely correct. And the distinction is whether they can be incarcerated. So what we consider a violation, which is a traffic ticket, you're not eligible for a court-appointed attorney. Now, many of the DUI prosecutions come along with Department of Motor Vehicles suspension hearings, and most court-appointed attorneys do not handle those suspension hearings because they occur before we are appointed to the case.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Further questions? Mr. Perry.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Perry. I'm with the Oregon Restaurant Association. We're also here to oppose the bill. I don't want to copy any of the previous statements. I just, one of the things that I guess I would like you to consider is when you look at the person that's a repeat offender and somebody that didn't either acknowledge they were at .08 or didn't acknowledge the penalty in the first go-around, obviously if they're continuing to do the same behavior, lowering it to .05, I don't think keeps them out of the car. Just from a conviction standpoint, I don't know of any people that are getting pulled over at .05, .08, but I think the mentality has to be how do we not work towards a conviction, but how do we keep them out of the vehicle? And so obviously the .08 and the penalties for those people have not been enough incentive to keep them out of the vehicle. So like Paul mentioned, I think when you get up the scale, like .20 or higher, there should be different penalties. This isn't a restaurant association perspective, but I always say that, you know, at what point should you lose your right to a diversion program? I mean, does .09 and .24 have the same right? To me, their level of risk to the public is an extreme example there. And so they're entitled under the same rights under the law, but the people that are continually ignoring the .08 are not people that are driving at .05, .06. There are people that are generally at .15 or higher. And so if it is the intent to capture the people that are in this basically frame, I think you have to figure out they're not scared at .05 or .08 in the current penalties, so lowering it to .05 I don't think reaches what we're intended to get after, which is somebody that's ignoring the law today, obviously the penalties need to be more extreme. A vantage point that I wanted to throw out, but we're opposed to it also.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
What I'd like to do with this bill is I would like the parties to try to get together and see if they can come up with some kind of a compromise on that and address some issues. One of them is of any timeline, like the 15 years, when does that start? Does it start from arrest or does it start from conviction, especially with referencing diversion? Would it start when diversion started or when you completed diversion? And I would like to see if you could take a look at possibly coming to a compromise, if you could reach a compromise. Maybe this should apply to people who are on the 2 years probation for their for the original drunk driving, maybe the time limit instead of 14 or 15 years. Just as a suggestion or a starting point to discuss it. But I would like to have the groups take that back, take a look at it, see if we couldn't come back later. Thank you. We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 2183. I'm sorry, House Bill 2183, and open public hearing on House Bill 2184. If I can have Chuck Hayes, Tim Weaver, and Stephanie Tuttle, please.
I guess I'll go first.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Chuck Hayes, and I'm representing also the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII this morning, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2184. The reason for that is I do have a background in law enforcement, a little over 30 years, and I do know that police officers are now encountering more people that are driving under the influence of substances other than what our present DUI statute covers, and that would be intoxicating liquor, controlled substances, inhalants, and then any combination of those. So we're asking that you consider that we could redefine the definition of intoxicant in the DUI statute so that it would include any substance that adversely affects a person's ability to operate a vehicle safely, and that would include some non-controlled substances that police officers are encountering. I can tell you that this has been addressed in 36 other states around the country. They have statutes now that include alcohol, controlled substances, and non-controlled substances as well because of the police officers encountering more people that are kind of mixing and matching and using some of these substances. And many of these substances that we are encountering were never intended to be abused, but unfortunately we find that people abuse them and misuse them and combine them with other things, which kind of exaggerates the intoxication level. These people that police officers are encountering, many times it could be a prescription medication, sometimes it could be an over-the-counter substance such as NyQuil or Robitussin that they have abused. And when I say abused, taking 2, 3, 4, 5 times of what they should be using and then go out and try to operate a motor vehicle. And when these people are encountered on the roadway, these people are acting just like an intoxicated person that would be intoxicated on alcohol or some of the illegal drugs that we're familiar with, such as methamphetamine, cocaine, those kind of things. So we're just asking that you would consider that. We can tell you this, that police officers in Oregon are probably encountering 200 or 300 of these individuals. We did do some extensive training in Oregon that I was part of while working for the Oregon State Police, where we trained officers as drug recognition experts. And since doing that in 1995, we have seen an increase in these type of arrests because police officers are now trained to look for those types of impairment. I can tell you when I started my law enforcement career in 1974, we had no training like that. And so we were encountering people out on the roadway that were impaired by these substances and really didn't know what to do at that point. And unfortunately, the majority of those people were probably let go and drove down the road. So with 36 other states and then with as many officers as we have that are trained as drug recognition experts, we're encountering these types of offenses and with the states that are doing all of the training as Oregon is. You may hear some testimony, I think, from Sergeant Weaver here on my right is going to be talking about a case that he had that involved a substance called dextromethorphan, which is commonly abused in NyQuil or Robitussin, those kind of substances. There's a lot of media attention that has been given to especially the Portland area about young people, teenagers that are using Coracetin and those kind of things to get high and can be deadly, as can the use of dextromethorphan or diphenhydramine or any of those type of substances. Because when you abuse those substances really just turn into something that's very similar to LSD or some of the hallucinogens, where people will actually produce some very psychotic effects and obviously should not be driving. I talked a little bit about the national level. There's a lot of national organizations like the Federal Drug Administration, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, and the Office of National Drug Control Policy that are all urging states now to take a look at their statutes that cover impaired driving and to consider going beyond just the controlled substances because of the problem that we're seeing nationwide. We do not feel that this is going to change in any way the way that police officers enforce impaired driving laws now. So it's not going to change the way that a police officer is going to enforce DUI because, again, we are looking for those people that are driving in some type of manner that has brought suspicion to themselves. The police officer makes the stop. The police officer does the field sobriety tests. And what they're testing for is impairment. They're not testing as to whether or not it's alcohol-related or drug-related or maybe some other substance that's related. It all comes down to the fact, is that person impaired? Should they be taken off the road because they are a danger out there on the highway? So we do not see that changing. In fact, I would be shocked if there was even an increase in arrests based upon passing the statute because, again, the police officer, he or she does not know what the substance is. It's just impairment. That's what they are arresting out at roadside. Now, this may have some effect is when, obviously, when that person now is brought in and they give a 0-0 breath test result. So the officer has concluded that it's not alcohol causing the impairment. So then that's when the drug recognition expert comes in, does the evaluation. And then that's usually followed up with asking for a urine sample. That urine sample then goes to the Oregon State Police Forensic Laboratory. And since we've started this program in the late 90s, the Drug Recognition Expert Program here in Oregon, the crime lab has been testing these urine samples for us now. And they report to us whether it is a controlled substance or a non-controlled substance. So we're not asking them to change their procedures in any way. Just continue to do what you have been doing for us since 1997-98 when we started testing the urine the way that we do now. So I don't see any change there. What I do see as a change of this statute, if it was to pass, it would give us a better handle and would also give our prosecutors a better handle to actually prosecute these people. Because now, if someone is arrested for DUI, there's no breath test or a 0-0 breath test result, and it comes back as a non-controlled substance, the majority, if not all of those cases, are being dismissed and never make it to the courtroom at all. And so we're missing out on people that could potentially have a problem with a substance. They don't get into treatment. There's no follow-up because we never get a chance to actually identify that. So that would help in that regard. So I just ask that you support this bill and urge that you would support it. And I'm available to answer any questions should you have any.
Any questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Hayes. Since we both have a little bit of that background here. I'm just kind of curious. I mean, the bill itself and the description of what's going on with that, my focus is more toward the meds, the medication issue. What are your thoughts, and I think you've probably experienced this as well as I have, the individual that visits the doctor and the doctor gives them a prescription, but at the same time, once goes to the cabinet, hands them a prescription drug to get something going on board in their body and everything. And in the meantime, the doctor says, you're only like, you know, an hour away from home. It shouldn't take effect for at least 2 hours, but actually what happens because the chemistry and everything in the person's body, it hits them in 30 minutes. There was no intent on that person's, you know, place to go out there and be under the influence of medication. What are your thoughts along that line?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Olson, definitely we have some thoughts there, and you're right. I mean, that has been an issue. Some states have actually addressed that by statute, that there is a defense mechanism in there if it is maybe caused by an adverse reaction by some sort of prescription medication. If the medication wasn't supposed to take effect for an hour or two and the person tried to drive home, but boom, it hits them before they get there and they're stopped and arrested, states have looked at that and actually written that into the statute itself. So Could we do that? Sure, we could take a look at those, and we can look at some of the states that maybe have that type of successful clause in the statute, because we're not intending to go out and pick on people like that with that type of enforcement. So our intent, and you know this from your years of law enforcement as well, is that people that mix and match and will just continue to take this substance because they're taking it for really one purpose, and that is to get themselves feeling an inebriated state or an intoxicated state. So those people that maybe are abusing the medications or abusing some of these over-the-counter substances, those are truly what we're trying to target. We're not trying to target someone that might have an adverse reaction. So it is something we could look at.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Last session we had a similar bill, and there was language that said that it would be illegal if it was intentional, if somebody did that intentionally. And then I think the bill just kind of went away because there's concerns that it would be very difficult to prove somebody intending to do that unless would be difficult in most cases. I mean, there might be the occasional case. So,
Mr. Chair, you're correct. We were asked to take a look at the intentional intoxication, but from a prosecutor's standpoint, and we do have a prosecutor here at the table today, they felt that would be somewhat difficult to prove intent. Some are not, but many would be difficult to prove, I think.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Please. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Tim Weaver. I'm a police officer with the city of Newburgh. I've been a sergeant there, officer and sergeant there, for over 26 years. I work shifts, and among those shifts, I work a fair amount with impaired drivers. And in 1984, I've considerable amount of training over the years, in 1984 and then again 1985, received training in drug recognition, expert training, and have over 5,000 hours in documented training and instruction time. I'd like to present to you a case occurred to me in this last year, Super Bowl Sunday, February 1st, 2004. Traditionally, this is a high volume day for alcohol consumption and also impaired driving. This case was a bit different in that one involved an impaired driver, including a crash within our town. Man was driving his pickup along a residential street, left the street, crossed an oncoming lane, traveled down about 75 feet of a sidewalk and into a privacy fence in an adjoining backyard of a home. He narrowly missed a large power pole. He drove just on the other side of the power pole was a family out for a walk with dogs and kids and strollers, and we had a potentially a very serious problem. The driver at the scene showed signs of what we thought alcohol impairment. Could very well have been alcohol impairment. Bloodshot, watery eyes, balance problems, speech problems, some incoherency, very stupid in appearance, relaxed physical appearance, minus one element, and that was the indicator of on the breath, alcohol beverage on the breath. There was none. The officers went ahead and made the arrest based on the impairment, and within an hour or so gave a breath sample, 0-0, by an intoxilizer. I came in as a drug recognition expert within an hour and a half, 2 hours, and the driver voluntarily went through an evaluation. I found very similar indicators. Again, as the officers at roadside had 4 points of 4 clues of 6 in horizontal gaze nystagmus, which is a very reliable check for police officers at roadside. I counted 6. He had showed significant problems in swaying and balance problems while walking and standing and turning. He was I stopped the divided attention exercises because of the balance problems. His one point I noted increasingly was his affect. He was becoming more and more incoherent, more stupid in appearance, and again, no alcohol beverage. Going back to with the officers meeting with them, I asked what was in the car, and there were a couple of bottles of Robitussin cough over-the-counter cough medication in the car. I asked the gentleman what his drug of choice was. If it was an alcohol, what was his drug of choice? He told me it was cough syrup. He was an alcoholic, and if he was caught with any alcohol in his system, he was going to suffer considerable problems with, in his case, a visitation with his family and his children. He needed a replacement for the alcohol, cheap, effective, and easy to secure and to get. Cough suppressant over the counter was his remedy. He said he felt the effects of the dextromethorphan or the Robitussin in the Robitussin. He said he felt the effects of the cough syrup, and especially at roadside. But as I noticed, even more effects in the drug evaluation sometime later in the security of a booking area and an interview room. He said he didn't feel those effects any longer, and he thought he was okay to drive. Yet what we found was he was actually more impaired than he was at roadside. This caused us quite a concern. Toxicology was went through the proper processes, and the only drug we found in his in his system at the time was dextromethorphan from the over-the-counter medication. The significance of this case is a couple fold. One, we had impairment. We had an impaired driver, yet we had no case because the DUI statute did not fit this particular drug this man was taking. Yet we had a person who not only was a potential, if he wasn't a potential killer, he came very close to seriously injuring some citizens. He did damage property, and he got away. He got away with his problem, because we found it was not possible to prosecute this case based on the statute. What one motivation I had for coming this morning is hopefully to help us see that we need to keep up our the statute needs to keep up with our culture. As we take drugs and our culture is widely accepted to take drugs to fix what hurts us, there is an increasing opportunity for abuse. We are not interested in causing problems with people who have to take drugs to fix their, to remedy their illnesses, but to target the abusers, because those abusers are a significant safety hazard for our communities. There should, in this case, as police officers arrest impairment at roadside, we would be going through the same toxicology tests and exams as we normally would, so there should not be any financial impact to our efforts in arresting drivers. We arrest impairment what we see at roadside, and we have to follow the statute from there and based on toxicology. If it's controlled substance, then we can act. If it's not, most of these cases go away, and we're asking for a favorable review of this bill.
Questions?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. I guess I'm a little disturbed by the word perceptible degree. Meaning, I'm thinking there could just be a little snot-nosed teenager pulled over, and for whatever reason, there's a human interaction, and he says something he shouldn't have said to the police officer, and then the police officer might want to just, you know, nail him for something, and just kind of look at him like, yeah, I'm thinking you're looking a little under the influence of quercetin or whatever. So, is there a, you're talking about this nystagmus or this drug recognition evaluation. Is that what is intended? to be used as a tool to measure the perception of being intoxicated by other substances?
Yes.
Okay.
And what we have found, especially over the last 20 years, is police officers need to catch up with the times as well in investigating DUII. And with the check for horizontal gaze nystagmus, if we have 3 days, I can get you through a good school. In the check for horizontal gaze nystagmus, scientifically, is validated as a reliable tool at roadside. Representative Thatcher, I suppose that would happen with a teenager at roadside. Well, you look like you've been look like you're under the influence of chloroseed. And first of all, that should not happen. That should not happen because we don't look for the specific drug. We look for a class section of several of seven drugs categories. But we're professionalizing a lot more than ever. And those officers who would take on a driver at roadside without cause is going to lose. We look for the impairment and we act on that. And from what I am seeing in my cadre of officers statewide, we are doing much better than we have than ever before.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have one. You said this guy was not. I mean, the implication was he wasn't charged. I was wondering why you wouldn't arrest him for reckless driving.
The perception in the community is one is we tried, we discussed this, and the definition of recklessness is how many judges do we have in the state, and the definition of recklessness and even carelessness is different for so many judges. And the bar for those for judges and juries to decide on recklessness is so vague. Unanimous circumstances this. What we are asking, we saw impairment, and we want to focus on impairment.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
We used 8 or 9 adjectives to describe these people, their negative appearance, and I would suggest that probably by May or June, this committee will look the same.
Mr. Chair, I just have a question, Sergeant. In your testimony, you talked about the discussion that you'd had with this the driver. Well, I'll say suspect, whatever. But that he related to you what his intent was. So I guess I'm a little miffed why reckless driving wasn't pursued on this. I mean, to a more stiffer degree.
Chairman Barker, Representative Olson, yes, we were disappointed as well. We can't take the case to court, and we had to trust in our district attorney at the time, and their staff saw a case that couldn't go forward.
Okay.
Representative Thatcher.
Yes. How many people do you think are let off the hook, so to speak, because this law is not in place?
I've been a drug recognition expert since 1995. Myself, I have, as I'm deep into supervision and training, there are DREs doing up to 50 to 60 evaluations a year. I get about a dozen evaluations a year. Every year I have one to two in 12. Of these people in this fall into this category.
In
over the counter, from my experience,
okay.
Probably around 10%, I would say.
Okay.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Stephanie Tuttle. I'm a prosecutor here in Marion County, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association to speak in support of this bill. If you were to talk to prosecutors across the state, you would find that every office every year has at least a handful of these types of cases where you have a person who is driving impaired, but not impaired by either alcohol or controlled substances. They're impaired by non-controlled substances. And unfortunately, we don't have the ability to prosecute them as the law currently stands. I can tell you about a case I reviewed a few years ago where a woman was driving very slowly and rather erratically down the road. She was weaving in her lane and caused the officer concern, pulled her over. She could barely keep her eyes open. She had taken way beyond the recommended dose of some form of a cold medicine and was quite impaired. In fact, she fell asleep at various points during the investigation. She was ultimately arrested when she went in and blew on the intoxilizer machine. It was a .00, and as the investigation revealed, she hadn't taken any controlled substances. This was a woman who was very dangerous. None of us would want to be driving down the road with this person. None of us would want our children walking down the street while this person was driving around. And yet, as a prosecutor, we could not hold her accountable for her actions. One of the problems with that is not only could we not criminally prosecute her, but we could not get her evaluated and find out what treatment help she might need. That's the bad point we're at in terms of being able to address this issue and why we're in support of it. One of the things I want to reassure you about is we're not looking to prosecute people who have a cold, take some cold medicine, and drive home. That's not the legal standard. The legal standard that I have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury in the community is that the person's driving was adversely affected and that they were affected by the intoxicant, whatever it was, to a noticeable and perceptible degree. That is a high standard for us to reach. And yet I feel like there are certain cases that we could do that where we're not able to. The case that I just mentioned, the case that you just heard about, are two examples of that. The issue regarding reckless driving has come up a couple of times here. And let me explain from a prosecutor's standpoint why that is such a challenging case to prove. Reckless driving requires the reckless mental state, which if you read the statute is probably that and criminal negligence are tied for the most complicated mental states to describe and prove to a jury. They're very complex in the way they read. They're very difficult to understand. And typically speaking, just from experience, without evidence of erratic driving, like, you know, when you're driving down I-5 and you see someone weaving in and out of traffic and cutting people off, we all say, where's a police officer when we need one? Those are the people we can convict of reckless driving. Short of that, it's very difficult to do that. As far as an intentional mental state, like intentionally ingesting non-controlled substances in order to become intoxicated, I can tell you that there would be very few of those cases that we would actually be able to prove. It's not going to take long for people to figure out that this is illegal, and they're going to say, gosh, I didn't mean to take too much. I didn't know it would make me intoxicated. I just didn't feel well. And that's what we would be faced with. That would be impossible for us to prove otherwise. And you might have a rare exception in the person who's got the Robitussin bottles in the back of the car, but I don't think that's going to happen very often. So what we're asking for you to do is give us the tool to hold the people that need to be held accountable, responsible for what they've done. And that's why we're asking you to support this bill.
Mr. Chair, how do you measure the degree of impairment, like from a prescription drug or something across the counter with alcohol? You take a blood test and you know at certain rates a person of a certain weight has normally effect. Is there any way of doing that with prescription drugs, or people may have a reaction to a drug?
Chairman Barker and Representative Krieger, you're correct. I mean, some drugs will affect people to a higher degree than others. The way we test for that is by interacting with them and seeing how they're acting. Are they acting like a normal person, or are they acting like someone who shouldn't be driving? I don't mean just tired and driving home. I mean tired to the point of falling asleep, not tracking with your questions, confused, the slurred speech, the watery eyes, the things that tell us that a person is not safe behind the wheel. And one of it's much more difficult to not assess, but measure that in the case of a controlled substance versus alcohol. If I have a controlled substance, I'm in the same position as I would be with a non-controlled substance. I have to go on observable symptoms. If I have alcohol, of course, if I'm lucky and the person takes the intoxilizer test, I have that measurement. But without the intoxilizer, frankly, it's the same with alcohol. I have to look at what the person's doing and how they're behaving. This gets at the fact that when you're in a certain condition, you're not safe to get behind the wheel of a however many pound car it is that, you know, with one bad turn can kill someone. So.
Any further questions?
Mr.
Person McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to offer this maybe a question or two here to the whole panel. I'll let you choose who should respond, or maybe Ms. Tuttle, you should lead off. It strikes me that the bill is pretty broadly drafted in that it picks up controlled substances, inhalants, and it's only by indirect implication that it would then those would even have to cause a physical or mental impairment. And I think what we're struggling with here, and I sense this from my colleagues as well, is that we're trying to separate the cases where people are intentionally trying to get high with substances other than alcohol, which is really the thrust of this bill, from the more innocent cases where a person may be impaired because of they happen to take too much of Robitussin because they've got a bad cough, or they have some interaction between prescription or patent medicines that cause an unintended result. So we're trying to sort that out, and it seems to me that this is a pretty broad definition here, and I'm wondering if there are a couple of directions we could go that would narrow it in a way that it would get at what we're trying to accomplish. The chair referred earlier to an element of intent that was in a prior version of this in the last session. Another maybe direction to go would be to focus on addictive substances as distinguished from ones that are non-addictive. If somebody's taking, for example, prescription medicine that's not addictive, but it happens to interact badly with their system, it doesn't seem to me that is a per se kind of threat to the public safety in a way that a substance is addictive. Could you react to those observations?
Yes. Chairman Barker, Representative McPherson. I think that what this kind of gets down to, what your question gets down to, is the intent of the person versus the effect of whatever the substance is. Mm-hmm. From a prosecutor's standpoint, what we're asking is to focus on the effect. This is just like we do with alcohol. I might have three beers not intending to be intoxicated and then get behind the wheel of a car and I'm over the legal limit. The history has been it doesn't matter my intent. What matters is I'm in an impaired condition and I shouldn't be driving. It's very important because of the damage that I can cause. I would argue that it's a similar situation here. I'm not asking that somebody who takes, you know, two cold medicines and gets behind the wheel, they're not going to be in this impaired condition for the most part. But if that lady that I told you about that was driving down the road barely able to keep her eyes open, if she was in that condition because of medicine that she took, why shouldn't she be held accountable for getting behind the wheel? She knows what condition she is when she makes that decision. That's the concern that we have as a prosecutor, is the condition the person is in driving down the road. Now, the problem is when you talk about proving intent, I intentionally got intoxicated. I intentionally got behind the wheel. Very few people are actually going to own up to that. On the flip side of that, I want everyone to remember that I might decide to charge someone, but I can never convict anyone. I don't have that power. That's the power of the community. That's the power of the judge if the judge is the one hearing the case. And if I go too far, if I charge the little old lady on the way back from the doctor's office, I'll tell you, as a prosecutor, I think I'd be crazy to do that because I can't imagine a jury in the world that would ever convict someone under those circumstances. On the flip side, if I have to, in every single case, prove that the person intentionally overdosed on the controlled substance or, excuse me, non-controlled substance, that puts me in a position where it's going to be very difficult for me to ever do that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Generally, our criminal justice system focuses on doing bad things, and this is a category of conduct in which we've identified the risk as being so high that even if a person hasn't done something caused damage, that the risk of them causing damage is so high that we then impose a criminal penalty on putting themselves in a position where something bad could happen. So that's what's going on here. We're not focusing on things that have actually occurred. And it does seem to me that in that setting, to try to distinguish between cases where there is a bad intent or there is a use of a substance that the pattern in which is to intentionally put oneself under its influence, that's an appropriate distinction to draw. So any further reactions?
Chairman Barker, Representative McPherson, I agree with you in terms of this is a crime where there might not be a harm before the person is stopped and arrested. It's one where we recognize the danger of it and stop it beforehand. And that, frankly, is why there is no mental state attached to driving under the influence. If you're looking at going to mental state, let me just tell you that I would suggest something less than intentionally. Another option would be knowingly. You could choose a mental state where somebody knowingly ingested the substance and ended up in the position that they were. I think that if you separate the mental state for other substances versus alcohol and controlled substances, we're going to get much more complicated in how the bill is drafted and how it will be used. But I would certainly think knowingly would be a better choice than intentionally. Again, however, I just want to stress that all the history of the driving under the influence of intoxicants law has been, I have a responsibility as a driver not to get behind the wheel of a car if I'm impaired. And whether that be impaired by alcohol or a controlled substance or a non-controlled substance, I should continue to have that responsibility. This law would say to the community, don't get behind the wheel of a car if you have taken too much of anything, whether it be controlled, alcohol, or otherwise, because that's how important the safety of the community is.
Chairman Barker, Mr. McPherson, I think we also need to look at holding exactly what Ms. Tuttle is saying, is holding our citizens accountable for actions, because these actions are not only by a choice, but they have such far-reaching effects. We've heard from a representative from Matt, which are mostly victims of impaired drivers causing a crash, and we have a fatality. We are only asking for a tool. We're not asking for the solution. And two final points, if I may. One, DUII, so many years of experience of interaction with these folks, driving impaired is a very important intervention tool of intervention, a DUII arrest. There's so many other things going on in that citizen's life. Many times people drive under the influence as a result of some of those events going on in their life. And we've, as a culture, we're still accepting it's okay to get your nerves a little numbed, get your brain a little bit numbed up, but because, especially we here in the West, cars, motor vehicles are so much a part of our lives, I can still drive home. And it's such a great safety hazard for the community. And what we are asking is, an old adage I've used for so many years, is the best traffic safety tool we have is a rearview mirror with a police car in it. And the best deterrent to impaired driving is enforcement. We do a lot, so many of the media campaigns, public service announcements, so many of the trying to impress safety and personal responsibility onto the citizens, but in the final boil down, the best tool we have is that fear of arrest. And word travels fast. Don't drive impaired because you will be caught. And that's irrefutable. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any more questions? Thank you very much, Colonel.
Thank you.
Ms. Sky, you wanted to speak on this one.
Good morning again, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Again, I'm Kelly Sky with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I have provided some written testimony. You should each get 2 pages. Unfortunately, I didn't staple it. OCDLA opposes House Bill 2184, and my written testimony gives a summary of what I'm about to say, and that is basically that this is such a broad net that is being proposed to be cast to capture a very small amount of very specific activity. This bill, the language in this bill is so broad. I've attached to my testimony the definition of substance that I obtained off the internet. As you can see, it's virtually limitless. It certainly could be drinking too much caffeine. It could be having that big turkey dinner that makes you sleepy. There really is no legal limit on what type of substance could be prosecuted. I believe that the language in this statute would be open to vagueness challenges. It provides no notice to the public of exactly what it is that you're after. A person reading that statute is not going to know that chloroacetin or dextromethorphan are the drugs that can cause a problem, or that they're the drugs that you are seeking to criminalize. In fact, I actually looked on my bottle of Robitussin before I came down today, and there's no warning about overuse or about driving after having taken too much of it. DUI is a strict liability crime, and I think most members of the committee have caught on to some of my arguments already. You are guilty of DUI whether or not you knew that you were under the influence. And so this, again, is a place where in our society, we've come to know, there's a general understanding that if you drink alcohol and you feel its effects, that you should not drive. If you use controlled substances that are illegal to begin with, you certainly shouldn't further that crime by driving. By adding any substance, you are going to sweep in all of the people that I think that you all have alluded to today. The little lady who takes too much cough medicine before she gets in the car, the person who takes too many no-dos. This may not be a case of where police officers are going out and arresting people who are using over-the-counter medications in moderation. Where it would most likely become a problem are people who make mistakes, cause accidents. They test their blood and they find, oh, they had chloroacetin in their bloodstream. We don't have a way to quantify the amount that is in the bloodstream and whether that actually contributed to the accident. So by opening this language up to any substance, any degree, we have no way of really determining what it is that was causing the problems with driving. This is why the reckless driving and the careless driving statutes are very usable statutes to cover any other substance that's not covered by DUI. The other point that is important to understand is you hear about these cases where people have sort of walked away, and you hear where the prosecutor is saying that she will not prosecute somebody who just made a mistake and overdosed on their cold medicine. But the problem is that By the time a person is arrested, they've been arraigned, they've been appointed an attorney, a lot of the damage is done. And that little old lady who may actually win, a jury may not find her guilty. She's been put through a significant amount of trauma that could have been handled in other ways. This bill would end up costing money, and again, I would say that that's money that should go into education and prevention. How many mothers know that their children could be abusing Robitussin? I submit to you that not very many parents know that these drugs are a problem, and it's not contained on the bottles. It is something that should be addressed preventatively and through education before we seek to criminalize that behavior. The reality is that every time we go near a road, we drive our car, we walk next to it, we ride our bike along it, we're putting our safety at the hands of people behind the wheel driving cars. And we all trust that those people are going to exercise good judgment, that they're not going to reach down on the floor to get the cell phone that they dropped, or they're not going to talk on the phone and be distracted, that they're not going to be reaching back to talk to their children or trying to file their nails while they're driving. We cannot legislate good judgment. And the default position should not be to legislate to criminalize all bad judgment, and that's what this bill will do. It possibly criminalizes any substance that could ever impair a person's ability to drive. So we oppose this bill.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Ready? Thank you, Ms. Sky.
Mr. Chair, the committee was also handed testimony from Tom Holt of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. Mr. Holt called me last week and informed me he would not be available to testify here today, so I assured him I would point out to the committee that his written testimony is included and that the State Pharmacy Association does oppose this bill as well.
Thank you, Ms. Mollard. What I'm going to do is ask, the same as we did in the first one, ask the parties to try to get together and see if they can clarify some of the questions that have been raised today and come up with an acceptable bill on this, and maybe work as well with the administrator.
I'm sorry.
Before we do that, Jeff Ross. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate having the opportunity to testify and having that pointed out. Again, for purposes of the record and members of the committee, my name is Jeff Rost. I'm with the Oregon State Police Forensic Services Division, and I'm here to represent the division today. I also supervise and oversee what is called our toxicology section within the Portland Forensic Laboratory, and so I'm routinely aware of and oversee the controlled substance and toxicology analyses that are performed within the laboratory system, particularly in cases where DUI is the issue. And I have submitted written testimony for purposes of the committee. I'd like to just paraphrase that if I could, and indicate that the Forensic Services Division is neutral on this bill. But we do want to point out to the committee that there is a fiscal impact attached to this bill for the Forensic Services Division, and not to disagree with Mr. Hayes, who testified earlier, because the standard in this bill is any substance that could cause impairment, it is going to place upon the Forensic Services Division the additional responsibility to identify any substance that is in the urine that could cause impairment. Currently, the methodology that we do use in the laboratory is that we look for the controlled substances first. Generally, we do this in urine. We do not have a method statutorily to acquire blood other than through a warrant or through consent. And so generally we're obtaining urine from these individuals. If we find a controlled substance and that controlled substance corroborates the impairment that is observed by the arresting officer, we generally then don't go forward and go on to report any other impairing substance that we might find in the urine. The only time that we would continue is if we were to not find a controlled substance, or if we were to find a controlled substance that were to that did not corroborate the impairment that the officer was seeing, then we might go on to look at the non-controlled substances and prescription medications. And so in a situation where we're now going to be required to look at any substance, we're going to be required to do additional workup on those samples to make sure that we're reporting not just the controlled substances or not just the substances that might corroborate the officer's opinion, but essentially any controlled substance that we may find. In addition to that, again, because the standard is now any impairing substance, we anticipate an increase in the number of contested cases where expert witness testimony is going to be needed on the part of a forensic scientist. We don't anticipate that there would be any additional arrests made under this law. So currently with the approximately 2,500 to 3,000 urine cases that the laboratory sees every year, it's really somewhat an estimate in order for us to get a grasp for exactly how many additional cases it will mean that we'll have to actually go and testify on. I heard Mr. Hayes mention that there were approximately 200 to 300 cases a year that he felt would be cases that would be additionally picked up as a result of this law. Certainly with the additional analytical time and the additional testimony, we're anticipating the need for at least one additional forensic toxicologist in the Portland laboratory and one additional forensic toxicologist in the Springfield laboratory in order to make up for the additional work that would potentially result from this legislation. So again, the division is neutral with respect to the bill. However, there is a note to the committee that a fiscal is attached to this bill.
Any questions? Thank you. I would like to still, we will take this to a work session today for the parties to try to get together. Ms. Mouad may be able to help coordinate that. One of the other things, along with the cost mentioned, I know there's a lot of federal money that comes in through ODOT, from Oregon Department of Transportation, that funds into the state police. And maybe we can take a look at that funding source and see if some of that could be redirected to the crime labs to be able to handle any additional load on that.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out as well that there has been additional written testimony on 2183 and 2184. Troy Costales from the Transportation Division did also submit written testimony only.
Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on 2184. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2185. We have Ms. Howard and Ms. Pratt again, please.
For the record, Vanita Howard, member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on Driving Under the Influence. This bill has a rather limited purpose. It simply talks about the hardship permit that is available to people who have refused a test to determine their degree of influence by alcohol or some other substance. Again, our committee has been discussing this issue for several years. And the problem is that the repeat offender who has been through the system has been given advice and has learned from his own experience that the best way to avoid a conviction for driving under the influence is to refuse the breath test. I almost hate to admit this, but I date back to the years when Oregon law required that in order to take a breath test, you had to get the written consent of the person who had been under the influence. That was almost impossible. But it doesn't take very long for these drivers to learn the system. So under the current law, these repeat offenders need wait only 1 year to get a hardship permit, the same waiting time as for the repeat offender who takes the test and fails it. In other words, there's really no incentive to take the test, but there is an incentive to refuse the test and weaken the evidence against the driver in any criminal prosecution of the charge. What this bill proposes to do is very simple. It simply says that the wait time to get a hardship permit after you refuse a test will increase from 1 year to 2 years. We've also submitted some testimony, written testimony from Jerry Cooper, who is unable to be here today because he's on the bench in Multnomah County. Mr. Cooper has been dealing with these issues both as a prosecutor and as a judge for quite a few years, and I think you'll find his testimony very enlightening on this subject, too.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from the committee? Ms. Pratt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Ann Pratt, and I'm a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. I don't have a lot to add to Ms. Howard's testimony, only just a couple things, and that's that drivers who refuse blood, breath, urine also a second time are considered repeat high-risk DUI offenders. Oregon has approximately 3,000 of these offenders each year. House Bill 2185 addresses some of these offenders as they slip through a crack in the sanctions of refusal of blood, breath for the second time in 5 years. These offenders are actually being rewarded when it comes to the hardship permit, and I won't go on to describe it. Ms. Howard's already done so. We are told by law enforcement, DAs and judges that offenders are advised by their attorneys to refuse on the second and subsequent time. And we're proposing a 2-year hardship permit wait for those who refuse. We want these offenders to comply with Oregon's implied consent law, and we need to identify them in order to get them off our roads. We would expect that this sanction change would prompt more second time refusers to comply. I have a couple statistics. I won't go into those. Just I would like to say that repeat offenders are 40% more likely to be involved in fatal crashes than those without prior DUIs. And over 70% of DUI offenders have alcohol abuse problems, and up to 50% are alcohol dependent. We certainly want them off our roads. And 90% of the general public see driving impairment as a threat to their personal safety. The high-risk driver is a huge problem in our country and our state, and is already resistant enough. Let's not make it easy for them to escape responsibility and accountability by rewarding them for refusing a blood or breath test. Again, Mothers Against Drunk Driving supports this bill, and the Governor's Advisory Committee urges you to pass this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? So if you refuse the second time, you lose the license for just 1 year, and if you were to accept that and fail it, you'd lose it for 1 year. So there would be, that's the disincentive to take it the second time.
Just for the hardship permit.
I just want to make that clear. Thank you. Is there anybody like to testify? Okay. Thank you very much. Ms. Skye?
Chair Barker, members of the committee that are still here. I'm Kelly Skye for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I just had two quick points to make. First of all is there is an incentive to take that breath test, and that is a statute that was passed last session by the House Judiciary Committee through your committee, and that is it created the offense of failing to submit to a breath test, and I don't recall what the fine was, but I believe that it was upwards of $500. So that's an offense that was created to address this very issue last session. The second thing that I would say is on behalf of OCDLA, we generally oppose the extension of license suspensions or denial of hardship permits. In general, we feel that people need to be able to drive in order to work and be functioning citizens in the community, and specifically a hardship permit, which is only granted if the person has a hardship or a need to drive during specific hours during the day. This keeps people employed. It gives them the ability to remain functioning, which makes it more likely that they will be successful in any sort of treatment that they would take part in. The other thing that I would add is that I think if you look at the statistics and you talk to officers and prosecutors about the people who drive while suspended, when we deny people's driver's licenses, we don't necessarily stop them from driving. What we do is stop them from driving while insured, and what we would like to have is insured drivers on the road. So OCDLA opposes this bill.
Okay, thank you. Any other testimony?
Mr. Chair, there is written testimony from Troy Costales of the Department of Transportation on this bill as well, but he is not going to testify.
Thank you. We're going to end the public hearing and open a work session on this bill. I'll entertain a motion to move this bill.
Actually, I entertain a motion that would be moved to the full committee.
Thank you. Okay, call the roll, please.
Representative
McPherson? Can we do a three vote? Three people, is that enough to vote?
I do believe you have a quorum,
okay,
so I
okay.
Think so.
Thank you.
Excused?
Yes, yes.
Representative Olson?
Yeah.
Representative Thatcher?
Yes.
Chair Barker?
Aye. And I'll carry the bill. That concludes the hearing on House Bill 2185 in the work session. No further business before the committee will adjourn.